Hello and welcome to Guess That Record. I am your host, Jackson Reed. This is the show where we talk about music and try to figure out which album I pulled from my collection. This episode of Guess That Record was originally released on December 20th, 2023. The guest is Jenna Andrews, who hails from my hometown of Calgary, Alberta. Jenna is a songwriter and producer who's best known for her work with BTS, for which she co-wrote the number one songs Butter and Permission to Dance. In addition to BTS, she's also worked with artists like Nelly Furtado, Roy Woods, and Noah Cyrus. With all that being said, let's get into the interview. How are you doing, Jenna?
I'm great. I had a cold this week, so it's, you know, not always the best time of the year because it's like the changing of seasons and I've been traveling a lot. But other than that, I'm great.
That's awesome. And where are we talking to you from today?
I'm in Nashville.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit reminds me of Calgary a little bit. For US places, right? It's kind of similar in some ways.
I totally know what you mean because I've been to Nashville. I actually performed in Nashville. That's why I was there to play a show. So it's a really cool town. I enjoyed it there. So
Love that. Cool.
Mm-hmm. I'm very excited to have you on the podcast today for a number of reasons. Firstly, you're the first guest that we've had on the show that comes from the world of pop music. So I'm interested to speak with you for that reason. But most importantly, you and I are both from Calgary.
And I know.
when we got the pitch to have you on the podcast, I was like, so she's a super successful songwriter from Calgary. Yeah, we're having her on the show. I'm a musician myself, so it's really inspiring to get to meet someone that's from Calgary who's doing all these amazing things. So yeah, it's really great to have you here today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's so cool to see Calgary get on the map these days, especially with Tate McRae and all, you know. It's nice to see people recognizing Calgary.
Yeah, definitely. And while we're on the subject of Calgary, I'd love to learn more about your upbringing here. So yeah, which part of town did you grow up in?
I grew up in the Southwest. What about you?
Southeast. Yeah.
Oh, what area?
Like Mackenzie Lake. So.
Oh, I love Mackenzie Lake.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy.
I know. And I read that you went to EP Scarlett for high school. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. That's funny because like I've had so many family members that have gone to Scarlett and it was like pretty much everyone but my dad went there because they sort of grew up in that area. And then I think my cousins went there recently as well. So I've had a lot of family through that school.
Where did you go?
I went to Beaverbrook. So not too far from Scarlett, but yeah.
Oh, cool. I went to Scarlett, and then for junior high, I was Robert Warren and Al Boya. I went to Al Boya for a year. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And, you know, obviously you're very busy and all over the place these days. So what's something that you miss about Calgary?
I think like I miss the aspect of nature and just like the feeling of home, I guess. You know, there's something, you know, obviously it doesn't necessarily feel that way until you leave, but there's a nostalgia whenever I go back. And as much as the winter sucks when you live there, it's nice to go back when you don't live there because the snow is actually so, I love it when you can just look out your window and it's such a warm feeling. Like, you know, it gives you the like rom-com Christmas vibes.
Right. Yeah. For sure. And another thing I read about you that I got to know about, did you go to Mount Royal for journalism?
I did for a year. And then I studied, I did a year and then I moved to Vancouver to start working on music or whatever. And, the professor there let me do a couple years online. So I have like a year left or whatever, but I essentially finished 3 years, two online and then one in person. But yeah, I did it. It was cool.
That's another coincidence because I also went to Mount Royal for journalism.
No way.
Yeah, graduated in 2021. So yeah, it's when I saw that, I just was like, that there's like a potentially a chance we had the same professors.
I know. who was like the head of the department?
Oh man, when I was there, well, it might have been Brad Clark, I think. Yeah, I think that was who was the head of like the School of Communications or whatever when I was going there.
Oh, okay. I don't remember. I'm trying to remember his name too. I can't remember, but it was such a great experience. And I did actually a lot of, I'm sure you did as well, but I did a lot of like internships, around Calgary. So like, at like Global and at like, a bunch of the radio stations and things like that. I was just trying to sort of get in where I fit in type vibes, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, moving into sort of your music, career a little bit here, what is the first song or the first album you remember hearing that made you take music seriously?
Oh, well, my mom loves music. Like she's always, my parents aren't like, I don't come from a necessarily a music family, but my mom just like is such a music connoisseur. So from the age of like 5, they had every vinyl known to man. So it was just kind of like old school, like R&B jazz. So like Donny Hathaway, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, things like that would always just be playing in our house. But really, I think in terms of like wanting to be an artist and feeling inspired, I think it was Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston for me.
Awesome. Yeah. And when you decided to start playing music, like, did you start on an instrument or was the goal sort of always to be a singer first?
I think the goal was always to be a singer. I think, you know, as a kid, you kind of don't understand the scope of everything that you can do in music, which is something that I love to talk about now, because I think, you know, there's so many options for musicians to be able to, you know, not have to be like, oh, if I don't make it as an artist, then I don't make it kind of thing, you know? So I think if I hadn't known that back then, maybe the options would have felt different. But yes, I wanted to be an artist. And I got this little keyboard when I was 5 or 6, and I just sang and taught myself how to play on it. And I really only started not to think I wanted to necessarily be a songwriter for other people, but I really started being interested in songwriting when I was about like 13 or 14. I started writing my own songs.
Right. And so then you go to Scarlett, you go to Mount Royal, but then you made the decision to move to Vancouver to try and have a career in music. What was it about Vancouver that drew you there?
Well, first of all, I went to Mount Royal for journalism because I think in my, like for me, I had already done so much musical theater and music growing up in whatever school I was going to. I figured this, like having journalism, as you know, it's like there's an aspect of it that doesn't, like obviously there's so much writing. So I feel like that was really a part of it and also taught me a different side of the business. So simultaneously, I felt like that was a good thing to have under my belt. But Vancouver was a choice because I had met, so I was opening for a lot of artists that were coming into Calgary. So basically I would talk to the promoters and say, if I sold this many tickets, could I open up for whatever artist was coming to town? And so I was doing that while going to Mount Royal and actually Scarlett too. And there was one particular promoter that had introduced me to a producer in Vancouver. And when that opportunity presented itself, I just thought I would take it and be like, I'm going. And also I forgot this part is that I think like 2 months before that happened, I tried out for Canadian Idol, which I don't really talk about a lot. It's hilarious. And I met this girl in line that I became friends with. And so I basically emailed her and was like, hey, can I sleep on your couch if I move to Vancouver? And she said, yes. So I was like, all right, I'm going.
Nice. And it was interesting to read because it's like how you got discovered is a very like mid 2000s way of being discovered because it was through a song you posted on MySpace.
Yeah.
What was the story behind that?
Well, okay. So when I went to Vancouver, I basically did a production deal and I recorded an EP, But in that time, I obviously had no money, and I was just sort of struggling artist at that point, and wanting to do it on my own, not sort of depend on my parents and things like that. So I had a waitress job. I worked at Earl's, which I'm sure you know because you're a Calgarian, and you're a Canadian. So I worked at Earl's, but then sometimes I just like would stay in my car, and sleep by the water at night because it was so far. The place I was living at was like an hour and a half outside of Vancouver. And I just loved being by the water. Anyway, so I wrote this song one year for my parents, funny enough, for Christmas. And because I was like, oh, I can't really afford a nice gift, so this should suffice. And ended up being like the favorite song on the EP, so I ended up posting that. And that's how, like, to be honest, I think that's probably how like most of the people then found me. I had a bunch of managers, a bunch of labels reach out, and yeah, that was kind of not the beginning because I'd already started, but sort of the beginning into like, the real game, I guess you'd call it.
And you eventually then signed a record deal with Island Def Jam, and in 2012 you released like your first like major label EP called Kiss and Run. And I had a listen to it, and it felt like the songs were quite Adele sounding, I thought. But yeah, how was that EP put together?
Well, it depends on what songs you listen to. I think that there's a song on there called Weapon that I could see where you would find the Adele reference. I think a lot of it too was inspired by a lot of, again, jazz R&B influences. That was very much the direction I was going in. So whether it be like, I love like Portishead and Massive Attack, and like when it came to my music, like there's a lot of those influences in that particular EP. But yeah, I think that was the last EP that I released while being on Def Jam, and I ended up leaving the label in either I think it was 2013. So that was the last thing. And I had previously released a single, I think it was in 2010, called Tumbling Down. But it was weird. I was signed there for like 7 years, but only put out one single and one EP. It was like totally different time in music. Now it's like if you don't put out a song every month, then you're like forgotten about as an artist. So it's weird,
So I guess not too long, like after that EP and everything, you made the decision to kind of switch to your current career path of like songwriting. What was the moment that made you realize you had to make that change, I guess?
Well, I'm never like that. It's never really like you have to do anything. Like even for me going to journalism, it's like to some extent, it's like, you never have enough tools in your belt. It's not a backup plan per se, right? It's just kind of like some life just throws these things at you and you just kind of go with them. That's how I feel, And I think the only thing that I will say is when I left the label, because my experience had been, not being able to put out so much music that I had created, I'd had like 300 plus songs and I put out 8 of them, right? So it felt in that sense very confining, and I wanted to be able to, be able to have people hear the music I was writing. So Canadian friends of mine, Magid Jordan, they were just starting their careers, and I had got the call to be, to ask to executive produce or be around to help develop them. And that was just like a fun thing. I was like, oh, I've never done this before. I've never written for other people. And so I just decided to do that. And that was one of the first songwriting things I'd ever done, and just kind of fell in love with it, I guess. That was really the beginning of it. So it was never a conscious decision. I think it just sort of happened.
Yeah, of course. And so I am kind of curious, like when you sort of get the job to write for someone, is it like, do you have to like pitch to like a manager or an A&R person, or especially since you're now like more established, is it kind of less formal for you to sort of get those gigs?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is, less formal for sure. I mean, in terms of the pitch game is tough. I mean, it's become tougher now because so many artists write their own music, especially with TikTok and stuff like that. It's not really the same as it once was in terms of like, I think at one point, like the majority of songs being cut were pitch songs. Now it's like you either write the song with the artist, and if you do pitch a song that they don't write, it's like 10% of people, artists will take them, or maybe 20%. I mean, those aren't, I mean, obviously that's not the exact percentage, but I mean, to be fair, like it's just, it's not, it's, and if they do take an outside song, usually if they like it, they'll ask to participate in it to some extent, which I love, by the way. But it's yeah, I think for me, rather than going through labels and like managers and executives as much, it's nice to find your like artist work, like, you know, I guess like Rolodex, let's call it, and just be able to, I send it a lot to the artists themselves, right? I think that it just feels very much more pure and authentic that way. But it's case by case. I mean, it really depends on what project it is. I mean, if it's an artist that I've never written with before, then yeah, I guess. But the music industry becomes so much smaller as you're in it for longer, if that makes sense. So everyone sort of know, it's like this, it's like actual high school. So for the most part, if you don't know the person, you know somebody that knows them and they know of you. So yes, it makes it a lot more less like, you know, like professional seeming, if that's, yeah.
You know, being a songwriter myself, I think the thing I find interesting about songwriting is that there's no correct way to do it. It sort of seems like everyone has their own process. So, yeah, like what's your process of writing a song?
My process of writing a song is like literally always sort of different. I like to take it from a more like authentic standpoint in terms of like I mean, the connection between like what you're going through and what it ends up being. Like for me, like I started a podcast myself about mental health because I found so many times in sessions, there's so much vulnerability there, and I think that that's, you know, therapy in itself. So I think when I'm writing with an artist, it doesn't always have to be like a bad thing per se, but it's just like a, especially if you're getting to know someone, there's such a, you break the ice by telling each other things that feel very like raw, you know, like it just feels like something where it's like you speed date and you feel like you've known them for a year after one session, and then you end up with a song that just feels like this like baby that you've created that you'll never forget that moment. And I love, that's one of my favorite things about songwriting. So I think in that sense, I would say that I just like to take it from a very like pure human to human, getting to know each other state, because that usually gives you the concept. It's like within 20, 30 minutes of conversation, you're like, oh shit, that's what we're writing about. But again, it's always so different. Like we're writing for this Netflix film right now, and it's like, you know, it's obviously they have a brief and they want a certain thing, so you follow that. So it's case by case, but in terms of my favorite way of songwriting, I would say it's definitely just like starting from the nitty-gritty and being able to really put realness into songs, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And this is something I'm kind of curious to get your thoughts on, because I come from like a classic rock background, and my favorite
Right.
artist is Bruce Springsteen. And when you look at the credits of his albums, you'll always see all songs written by Bruce Springsteen without any other writers involved. And you know, I feel like back then, if there was like group songwriting, a lot of the time it would strictly be duos like Lennon McCartney or Jagger Richards. But you know, in today's musical landscape, it's not out of the question to sometimes see, you know, like six songwriters on one song. Why do you think it's become more of a thing to have a lot more people involved in the songwriting process?
I think like now music has just become differently competitive. I think like before, you know, obviously people recorded all raw instruments and it was even recorded to tape and things like that. Now it's like, you know, everything's programmed. There's so many sounds available on things like Splice, and I think that I don't know, there's like I think record the this the I don't even want to say it's like the competition of it, but I think it's important to be able to you know, be innovative and those kind of things. And I think there's always so many new things coming out, you sort of have to like meet the minds in the middle, if that makes sense, because it's not just like a band going in and recording it. It's different because there's so much like MIDI and so much like, you know, it's not all like raw instruments, I think, you know. And in terms of songwriting, I don't know how that, I guess like that's an interesting question. I mean, people do ask that a lot. I really don't know how that sort of happened, but I think collaboration is so amazing, and I love that that happened.
It's, you know, it's also like sometimes you see it on like the production side of things as well, where, you know, you back in the day, of course, it would usually just be one producer, and now there's like, you know, a ton of producers on most albums. Continuing about that on producing, because that's another thing that you have been doing a lot more of. What I think it's also sort of like songwriting, where there's no right or wrong way to approach producing. So how did you get your start producing, and then what's your process of working on a record in that capacity?
Well, for me, production is I started as an executive producer. So, I mean, I really like d again, one of those things I sort of fell into and didn't realize how much I loved it, but I as I started working like in a lot with particular artists, so as I was songwriting, I started to find like artists that I would lock in with for like 8 months to a year, like the band Perry or an artist named Banks. And as I was going through that, I even Magic Jordan in the beginning, and I just started to like meet people and really love the idea of development. And so there was an artist that I had met named Lennon Stella, actually from well, she's Canadian but lives in Nashville. She was on the show Nashville. I met her, wrote with her and her sister, and I was like, wow, this is somebody who I like absolutely adore and like think she's incredible, and wanted to be a part of developing and like, you know, really being in it with her to help develop her sound and like just being able to help create the whole picture, I think, as a partnership. And ended up signing her to records with Barry Weiss, which is crazy because Barry was actually the head of my label when I was signed to Island Def Jam, so small world. But ended up consulting for him as an executive producer, and ended up executive producing and A&R-ing Lennon Stella, and then after Noah Cyrus as well. And I think the executive production role is, you know, it's you're not actually like programming sounds. I'm not doing any of that kind of thing, but it's kind of understanding the scope of what you want to hear, and also like between you and the artist, you can come up with what sound you feel like it should be for the record, you know, and also just picking the songwriters. And I'd been doing it long enough to really you know, understand who I thought would be good in the room with each of them, you know, so I would be able to like not only musically but personality wise. So just putting in the right combinations of people to write for the albums was so fun. So it's kind of like production, like producing a movie, right? Like you kind of put all the people in play. And then also, you know, I vocal produce as well. So that's another part of it where I love to make vocals sound like synths and like, you know, just like find the musicality within the voice. And I think that really helps, that helps me in a lot of ways to see the vision for songs as well. To because a lot of times I think you hear a song and it's like 80% there, and the extra 20% could be in the vocal production. Anyway, so with all that said, it's I think that's how I really started being a producer per se, was through executive producing and vocal production. So yeah.
Cool. And you know, this is one thing that I think is, you know, really cool about what you're doing is the fact that you've been successful at all of this as a woman. And a couple episodes back on the podcast here, I interviewed Susan Rogers. And she was Prince's engineer during the 80s. So she worked on Purple Rain, Sign of the Times, like basically the biggest albums of his career. And then she went on to be a producer for like the Bare Naked Ladies and David Byrne from the Talking Heads. But it's crazy to think about her being a producer and an engineer back then, because like there were hardly any women in those jobs back in the day. And, you know, even right now, it's still quite rare to see women in those roles, sort of like behind the desk. Because I saw a statistic that like only 3% of producers are women and only 14% of songwriters are women. And I think things are improving for women in the music industry as a whole, because there are probably more successful female artists right now than at any other point in history. And the 3% of producers, I'm sure, is a much bigger number than it was even, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. But firstly, why has it been hard for women to get those kind of behind the scenes jobs besides gender power dynamics? Because I'm sure that plays a huge role. And then what's being done to change that to get more women songwriting and producing?
I think That is like always a little bit of a hard question to answer, in the sense that, like, I think that the majority of producers are men, right? So I think that that's just sort of been how it's been. And I'm not sure that girls, like, I think now obviously it's like you said, it's totally different, because I think girls try it now, they go to school for it, things like that. But I don't think that, like, it's been that much time where I think that girls really even thought to try that, if that makes sense. And I don't know where that started. Maybe that's like a, you know, it's just one of those societal rules that people follow. I like, it's just, again, it's a really weird thing. But I think that what's really interesting to see now is, like, you see all these girls going to school for it, for production, and now you're seeing more girls come out and be really great producers. I mean, I have so many female friends that I think are great producers, like, you know, Alex Hope. I don't know, she's really amazing. This girl Pom Pom, she, like, Alyssa Vanderheim, she's in Nashville. Like, there's a bunch of female producers that are really getting hit songs now, which is so great to see. But I just don't know that, like, girls were even trying to be producers back then. And I think that producers sort of, you know, obviously the reason why there's so many men in the creative side is, I think, mostly there's so many producers that also songwrite, right? So, like, that's why there's majority of men, because all the girls just songwrite. And again, I think it's something too that females, I think, especially as kids, think that they, you know, their way into the industry is being an artist. And that's not kind of what your first question was to me, or like, oh, did you ever think of doing anything else? I think that, again, maybe it's the kind of thing where you think, oh, well, this is the way that I get into music, but you didn't realize all the other things that you could do as a female trying to get into music. So it's definitely not like that anymore. And I think the number will continue to, you know, increase as time goes by. But in terms of being a songwriter, it's an interesting job, because, you know, again, it's in terms of livelihood, it's hard to sustain yourself without having hit songs, because there's no other way to monetize your efforts. So it's definitely a crazy world, because even if you think about it, like, all the other paid people, like, including, like, the engineers, or, you know, the mixers and all these things, like, everyone's paid for their job, except the songwriter. And so, I mean, it's an incredible job, but it's just maybe harder to sustain unless you have songs that are actually doing something, right? So.
Now to bring it back around to your career, I think like the last, 3 or 4 years have probably been like the high point for you so far. And it kind of got started when you co-wrote the song Supa Lonely for Benet. And that song was interesting to read about because it didn't really find widespread success until it became popular on TikTok.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was kind of crazy, because we had written it in August 2019, and it came out, I think, in November, and it wasn't even supposed to be a single or anything. And like you said, it just, that's what TikTok is great for, right? You know, there's a bunch of positive and negatives about TikTok, in my opinion. But the positive is that you can just put out a song, and the fans will find it, and you song that you would never necessarily think that could be your biggest hit will end up being your biggest hit and change your life. So anyway, it ended up just being a very, like, lighthearted, but also, like, had so much. I think it was, like, so interesting to see how it blew up during COVID, just because I think it really brought joy into something. You know, it was like she wrote it about a breakup, and I think as much as it was fun and light, it was also, there was, like, some really, like, I don't know, with her voice, I just feel like she made people feel good during a time, you know. And it became, like, you know, it became the pandemic song. So that was just an interesting time in history for me too, because obviously, you know, I believe that that song will always have a place in people's hearts during that time, you know. And I loved that being, you know, the first big hit of mine, because I just think, you know, it was such a crazy time in history. And also, I just love her, and it's so nice to enjoy the ride with people that you love. So.
And or actually, yeah, I was going to mention, I don't know if you know about this or not, but when I was looking up the song, I saw that Elton John was praising it. So that's pretty cool to say that Elton John has a song that you wrote that he's a fan of.
Oh, I know. That was really cool. Yeah, I think he I want to say, I don't know if he like went on stage with her or something, like he or he definitely something happened with him, that and her during that time. So yeah, that was cool. Of course.
And you know, since Super Lonely is an example of a song that became popular through social media, I've seen some people say how, like, you know, that's what artists need to be focused on when they're writing music, is like, you know, it has to be geared towards TikTok. So what I'm wondering is, do you think that, like, good music will find its way no matter what, or do artists really need to be focused on going viral as like their first priority?
I mean, I think music should be the first focus. I think that that's where it's gone really wrong over the last couple of years. I think TikTok and analytics and those type of things show labels what's working. So I think that it makes it easier to know if you put out a song whether or not it will do numbers. But I think music is still there's a lack of like real artistry in the last couple of years because of TikTok. I think that you see so many one song hits. And then people either don't know the artist's name or the artist can't have a hit after that. And it's like they don't have the chance to really develop a career. And I think that people miss that. I really do. I think that there is something about watching an artist really like grow and become something, and like knowing them and feeling like you were in that journey with them is something that creates real fans and people that will go to your show. Whereas like just being like, I love that song, and like not necessarily having the like putting two and two together. So I think that coming into this next era of where music is going, I think we're gonna get, I think that eventually we'll get out of this phase back to like real artist development.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely with you there. I know it's like with my own music, I feel like social media is the one place where I really struggle with, because it's not totally my thing to, like, you know, scroll on my phone, and I just have never been into that, like, culture, I guess. So it's the one area that I wish I was better at. But yeah, anyways. So we've also got to talk about BTS, because working with them has really brought you a crazy amount of success. So yeah, how did you get started working with them?
Well, I started working with them during COVID as well. After Super Lonely happened, they were reaching out about doing various projects on HYBE. And that's how I first started knowing people at HYBE, the label behind BTS, TXT, etc. And then Dynamite came about and they asked me to vocal produce it. So I ended up vocal producing Dynamite and it came out and was their first, obviously big English hit. And that was just so exciting to be a part of. And I think at that point, given the success of that, they were, I was definitely in with that camp. So I was in the conversation for pitching for the next song. And with Butter, it was crazy because it's such a long story how it really happened. But essentially, my partner now that I work on everything with, Stephen Kirk, he had a song that he had written in like 2019 that had the production that you hear today of Butter and then the original hook melody. And Rob Grimaldi, who was signed to 27 Music, that my publishing company with Barry, had sent me the song, and I didn't know Steven at the time, but had sent me this demo, and I was just like, oh, this is like perfect. We should work on this. And so we took that and we essentially changed the lyrics to be Butter and all those things and sort of buttoned it up to what it is now, sent it to them, and they fell in love with it, and it was just ended up being what it was, what it is today, which is was such a blessing. And obviously, like, when you have that type of record, given that, again, me and Steven are partners, for example, it's just like there's so much that came out of that song besides just the song. It was just like partnership and like other amazing songs and just the relationship with BTS and having, one of the biggest songs in the last 10 years is just like crazy to think about.
Yeah, no, and it's like you were saying there, it hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100, which is like such an amazing accomplishment, because, you know, like, there have been all-time greats that have never done that. So to be able to have that, you know, on your resume is just like, it's got to be a real thrill.
Well, it was actually number one for 10 weeks.
Nice.
So it's actually like even crazier. Because I mean, like, like, of course, I mean, to answer your question, it was amazing. But like to have a song that went number one for 10 weeks, I mean, that's like extra rare. I mean, it was just, again, it was all so surreal to some extent, but also like not in a weird way. You know what I mean? Because I think that once you like, we put so much effort in like, that was the one thing about COVID is that, you know, obviously like no one was doing anything. So I think just the focus and attention that we put into this one baby really paid off.
Yeah. I didn't actually realize it was number one for 10 weeks in a row. So that, and I think like in this day and age, it's really hard to do that since there's just so much more music now. So, yeah, that's awesome. And then, right after that, you got to do another number one song with BTS, and that was Permission to Dance. And I saw that Ed Sheeran was a co-writer on that track. So how did he get involved?
Well, so he originally had the song, and but BTS, it was for him, it was for his own project. And so basically, he had sent it to me to write because I had been writing, doing so much for BTS to write lyrics more geared for BTS, which was such a obviously a compliment that Ed had trusted me with one of his songs. So I essentially just went and rewrote all the lyrics. I mean, we kept obviously the title Permission to Dance and like a certain few words here and there, but essentially just tailored it for them. And then Steve Mack and Steven produced the song together and sort of brought it more into the BTS world because again, before it was an Ed Sheeran song, which was amazing and I think what attracted to them to the song in the first place. But you know how it is. And that's another way reason back to your other question where other creatives come in together a lot, because again, that ends up happening is like you have one and because connection through social media is so amazing today where you can just have friends all over the world. It's like you can have like a song that you created. Look at what happened with Steven or with Ed. It's like you might have created that with your own project and then you send it to a friend and they send it to another and then you end up there's all these writers that end up on the song because of the way it's been shared and just I don't know, connection in that sense. So if that gives you an example why you've seen more than one writer on these songs today is basically what I'm yeah.
And so Ed had the music put together basically for this song.
Well, it was originally Ed and Steve Mack, and then they had brought me in for the lyrics and Steven in for the music to co-produce with Steve Mack. So
I
yeah.
gotcha. Yeah. It yeah, I thought it was like it definitely felt like kind of it sort of reminded me of a 70s song in the lyrics. Like, you know, we were talking about Elton John. It was sort of like Don't Go Breaking My Heart, or maybe like Changes by David Bowie. That was sort of I liked the vibe of it for that reason.
Oh yeah, cool. I will always loved Permission to Dance too. That was one of my favorites. I just it's so feel good. It's just like classic sounding. I mean, it kind of reminds you of like a like Jackson 5 too. And you know, it's like which it's so it, I just love it. I love the chord progressions. Like every I was so excited to work on it at the time, so.
Yeah. And now before we move into the guessing section of the show, I also wanted to bring up another recent project of yours, and you'd mentioned it earlier, and that's your podcast, which is called The Green Room Talks. I checked out a few episodes, and I think it has a really interesting format for a podcast. So it would be great if you can share what the show is about and how you sort of put it together.
Well, it's essentially about you know, obviously about mental health and just various forms of it. I think, you know, I've always struggled with anxiety and various mental health issues, panic attacks, things like that. But I've always, you know, there's a point where you feel ashamed and not really wanting to talk about it. But I think at the breaking point where I really decided to be open about it in sessions and things like that is where I really began to see the songs that were coming out and the beauty and the relationships I was making. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. It's very much like a therapeutic, you know, safe space feeling that I want to create in the green room where it's like it's me, the artist, and or whoever the guest is and a therapist. And I think, you know, as I was explaining before, it's like this very much natural conversation that comes up. And in a lot of the episodes that you do watch, there is like some sort of phrase that's used that in a songwriting room, normally you'd be like, oh, that's the concept. Like, it's perfect for this song. And I think I was trying to, you know, show people that that's how authentic that so, like songwriting can be, right? But also including the mental health aspect. And I think for fans, especially of certain people on the podcast, I think it's interesting. And I've seen it Because I've done it in various forms. Like we did it on Twitch and YouTube Live and like Twitch and things like that. Or said Twitch, Zoom Live and things like that. Like there was a lot of different ways we did it in COVID, and people were on live watching and commenting about how much, it was nice to see their idols talk about similar things that they were going through. So I think it's like the music industry or the entertainment industry as a whole can be very much smoke and mirrors. So I think that when you really start to see like, oh wow, this person's not so different than me in ways, that I think that it's really amazing to bring people together and really just help. It's help the healing process, I guess, and I think if I was a kid watching a show like that, I was thinking, like a Mariah Carey, for example. Like if you were to see her talk about the very similar things that you went through as a kid, you would feel a little bit less ashamed of your own self going through it, or feel less bad about, having a panic attack at school or something and not feeling like, oh, it's only me going through this, especially when it comes down to your idols. So that's another thing. And I think the therapist is there, it's because I'm not obviously a therapist. So it's like to have someone really there that's a trained in their field and be able to give advice not only to the guests but to people watching. Is really cool. And there's like so many various helplines that we can provide. And like I've partnered with like the Jed Foundation, and she is the music, which is obviously, to your point, again, we talked about females in this industry. I think, that support is really cool after the episode as well, just to have people reach out. And they do. I mean, there's been people that have reached out and really seeking help, maybe have never had therapy before, watched the podcast and are intrigued by therapy and want to do it. That's another thing. And also on the flip side, it really helps to see the songwriting process. And so there's so many things. And I'm trying to expand it now, though. Like I really think that it started as a music thing for songwriting, but I think it can be really for anyone. Like I think that everyone has a story, and I think it's interesting to talk about mental health as a whole and make it feel like, destigmatize it as much as possible. And I know that it's already come so far from where we were, even 10, 15 years ago, where, to admit that you have any sort of mental health issue was like, I mean, was basically like having some sort of, something on your face. Like it just was so embarrassing. People, it just wasn't accepted, right? But now I think it's come so far, but I think it has to continue to become that way, even in things like the workplace. I mean, that could be interesting to go into next, because I, for mental health, but also being a woman. I mean, imagine as a woman having to go to a big meeting and having a panic attack, like telling your boss, "Oh, sorry, I can't attend this meeting because I'm having a panic attack." I mean, that could potentially be a fireable offense. Whereas, like, if you had a cold or the flu and you couldn't help but throw up in the bathroom, you're not getting fired for that. So, it's just these things that I think is healthy to be exposed and also just feel a little bit, there's like so much humanity in it, I think. So
And I think you hit the nail on the head. Like it is I today people are more willing to be open about mental health, and because it was a very taboo subject for a long time. And so the more discussions that are had about mental health, I definitely think that inspires people to look for help when they're not feeling good. And like you were saying about having a therapist, I think that makes your show very interesting and unique, because the fact you have that like expert advice right there on the spot, I can't say I've seen a show do something like that before. So that's a great idea. And I also wanted to ask, because since I've obviously taken the plunge into podcasting myself, what's been sort of the most eye-opening process about podcasting that you've found?
I think interesting about eye-opening. I think the clickbait aspect of it. I think that's been interesting for my particular podcast, just because I think because it's such a pure, like, safe space to be able to get some people's attention with what's like without it being harmful to the guests, if that makes sense. Because I mean, what we're talking about is so it's kind of an interesting thing to do, because technically the whole reason why the safe space is there is so it remains in that room. So if you're actually able to go on a podcast where you're willing to have other people listen to what you're saying, which it no longer becomes technically safe, it's like you don't want to bring these things out of people and want them to share things that they wouldn't be comfortable to put out there, you know, in another way. So I wouldn't want to expose that in clickbait, if that makes sense. So it's kind of a weird, it's a weird thing because, you know, people are just so, their attention span's so small now. So it's like, you've got to be careful about what you're bringing people in to watching the show without like alienating the guests that are on the show as well. So I guess I'm trying to sort of figure that out as I go, but you know, it's for me, the podcast is so fun because it's sort of like a, you know, just like a passion project. So I think it's just nice to be able to see it grow in baby steps. And I'm not really worried for like instant gratification for it. It's just like, for me, I'm more concerned with like helping people. And if it touches one person, you know, per episode, then that's great. You know, I mean, I interviewed Dixie D'Amelio because I worked on her project last year and she put it on her, you know, D'Amelio show on Hulu. So that's cool. But I mean, you know, things like that. I mean, things will happen naturally. I think the universe sort of points you in the right direction. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. So we are now entering the guessing portion of this podcast.
Okay.
For which it gets us in. So inside this, I'll explain the rules for you and to any new listeners we may have. In this bag that I'm holding is a record from my collection. And what I'm going to do is I will give you three clues about that album. And then we just play a game of 20 questions to try and figure out what the album is. And if you're stuck, I will give you hints. It's not like a serious competition or anything like that. So no pressure or anything, but Jenna Andrews, are you ready to guess that record?
I'm ready.
All right. So here are your three clues. This album came out in the 1970s. It's a duet album. And the duo on this record would later have another hit together years after they made this album. Question one.
Oh, is it Donny Hathaway and Roberta Flack?
Wow. That you are the first person to ever get the record in the first guess. It was.
No!
Yep.
I love that! That's so cool. That's cool. I mean, I love that it had something to do with what I grew up on too. So it sounds like me and you are on the same page.
Yeah, no, that was, I'm very impressed. That was awesome. And so you mentioned to me both before the interview and during that Donny Hathaway was one of your favorite artists. And so this was an interesting record for me to kind of dive into because I will admit that I wasn't super familiar with him before the podcast, but it's been cool to sort of check out his work from all this.
Yeah, he's just amazing. I feel like his story and, you know, everything about him was just so, I mean, his voice, like the way he sang, I think just really touched my soul in a way that I feel like so many, I don't know how to explain it. Like, I think that every single song he sang, I really believed it, you know, mm-hmm. And I think it's really hard to do that as an artist and really captivate the listener in every single song. I don't know. And I think his life story again was just so amazing. And I just feel like I really feel him. He's like genuine therapy listening to his songs. So it's like really amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. And kind of good timing to be talking about him as well, since, you know, we're recording this in December. Christmas is right around the corner. And
I know
he did This Christmas, which is probably his most recognizable song to the general public, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Oh my gosh. I should just play this right now. Play it right now after we get off. I mean, it's that song, the way he did that song was just, oh, so great. I mean, and like, it's so interesting because I know Chris Brown did a version, I don't know when, but he had a movie. I think it was called This Christmas. But anyway, he sang it. And I think his version was based off of the Donny Hathaway version because all the runs and all the stuff that Donny does. I mean, obviously there's so many versions, but I mean, obviously my favorite's Donny's.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And before we continue the discussion, I'll share some facts about the album for those who may be unfamiliar with it. Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway is a duet album by Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway. Released in April 1972, the idea of a collaboration between the two artists was put together by Atlantic Records head honcho Jerry Wexler, who thought that a duet album would help both of them sort of reach more success, as they hadn't really found that that major commercial success to that point. And it ended up being the right call, as the album went gold and produced the top five hit, Where Is the Love? Going back to kind of just talking about Donny specifically, reading about him, it was interesting because he's definitely got, you know, like that kind of incredible vocal talent and had sort of all the tools to be successful. But because he died quite young in 1979, I feel like he's sort of been forgotten about compared to a lot of the other singers from that era.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think so. I mean, but you'd be surprised. I mean, I don't know, because I feel like I live a lot in my, like, my world and my, you know, my music taste. And I feel like when I bring up Donny Hathaway, for the most part, people do know who that is. I mean, I think if they don't, then I mean, okay, put it this way, if you're into soul music or R&B or jazz or any of those kind of that style of music, you're gonna know Donny Hathaway. Mm-hmm. So I think that it really depends on, like, if you're just like a hyper pop person, and you know, like, of course maybe you wouldn't have known Donny, well, I mean, I guess back then you would have, but like, you know, you wouldn't maybe be as interested to know, like, for example, like Kim Burrell is one of the best R&B singers ever, and a lot of people in pop that don't really listen to R&B wouldn't know Kim Burrell, but she's an icon, absolute goat in R&B. So it's kind of like, it's all relative in that sense.
Definitely. Yeah. And I probably said that because, you know, of course I'm like a rock and roll guy, but I mean, I do try and, you know, cause I do like soul and a lot of this type of music, but I guess I'm sort of more familiar with like the Marvin Gaye's and the people that, you know, really had a lot of success crossing over into the pop world.
Right. I get that.
Yeah. And this album with Roberta Flack was actually a good one for me to take a look at, because it did have some songs I'm very familiar with. And one of the tracks they did a cover of was You've Got a Friend, which of course was written by Carole King and definitely made famous by James Taylor, who his version went to number one on the charts. But, you know, Roberta and Donny's version was great because I feel like it was sort of just taking the song as a whole, but giving it sort of a, you know, soul, maybe even a gospel flavor to it. And I think it shows like how powerful that song is and how durable it is, because it, you know, of course it sort of started off as like this folk pop song, and then Roberta and Donny could really do the arrangement their way and still have it sound great.
No, exactly. I mean, that's always a true testament for a song, if you can put it in any genre and have it sound like a great song, right? So.
Mm-hmm. And it was also another well-known cover they do was, and this was kind of the opposite where they really changed it, was You've Lost That Loving Feeling, which was originally done by the Righteous Brothers. And that Righteous Brothers version, of course, is very famous for, it was produced by Phil Spector. So it's like probably one of the best examples of Phil's wall of sound production style. But Roberta and Donny's version is like completely different. Like they changed the melody, feels different and everything like that. It was that was an interesting one. And it's always interesting when you find covers like that, where they really do it differently than the original.
Yeah, no, totally.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, the other sort of big song from this record was Where Is the Love? And as I mentioned, it reached number five and number five on the Billboard Hot 100. And it was interesting because I then found out that they had another hit together, which was an even bigger hit in 1978. And the song was called The Closer I Get to You, which hit number two on the charts. And that was interesting to kind of see the timing of that song, because it came out sort of a year before Donny passed away. And it's kind of too bad that he had this big hit right before he passed away there.
I know.
Wasn't able to sort of build on that. Yeah.
I know. It's crazy.
So we have reached the end of another episode of Guess That Record. I want to thank Jenna Andrews for taking the time to come on the podcast. Like I said at the beginning, I'm a musician myself, and I'm still working my way up and trying to get my foot in the door. So to speak with someone from Calgary who's doing all these incredible things in music is a real honor, and I'm very thankful to get the chance to speak with you.
Okay, great. I love this. This is amazing.
Yeah. Thank you so much for tuning in to that amazing episode of Guess That Record. Feel free to check us out on social media. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. And we have the same username across all three platforms, at Guess That Record. You can also check out our website, www.guessthatrecordpodcast.com. Remember to keep rocking, and we'll see you on the next episode of Guess That Record.